Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature a conversation between two superstar YA authors, Marissa Meyer and Tochi Onabuchi, moderated by Multnomah County librarian Alicia Tate. The event was entitled Deadly Magic, Vengeance, Justice, and Destiny, and took place at the Portland Book Festival in 2018. Both writers deploy magic and the fantastical to build worlds that transport us out of our own. But their stories are not pure escapism either. Underpinning both writers' work are issues personal and political that we all face every day. But by altering reality, we get a fresh look at age-old issues. This conversation moves from American politics to Nigerian food, from superpowers to the importance of diversity and representation in books, from old-school anime to fan fiction. It is a joyful conversation that delights in the intersection of serious literature and pop culture. Whether you consider yourself a fan of YA or not, I know you will enjoy these two brilliant writers go back and forth, and by the end, you might just count yourself a fan. Here's our moderator, Alicia Tate.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. I am kind of fangirling up here with these amazing authors. So, you know, bear with me. I would love it if each of you could tell me a bit about your most recent novel.
So it's funny because I've been trying throughout this entire like tour cycle to figure out how to talk about book two when I had this whole book one like speech and like, you know, little dance like prepared and everything. But book two, for those who have read Beast Made of Night, picks up right where book one left off. So if you got to the end of book one and you were really mad at me, just know that there was a plan all along. I was very happy to come back to that world and expand it, but also to delve into more of the themes that Taj has to struggle with, themes of guilt and you know, going back to finish what you started, and all these things with regards to responsibility that he got a taste of in Beast Made of Night, but now really has to grapple with. And also, the monsters get a little bit bigger.
Because they weren't big enough in the first book. My newest book is Arch Enemies. It is the second of the Renegades trilogy. And this is a series that takes place in a world of superheroes. And it follows two main characters. On one side, we have Nova, who has been raised by a group of supervillains. And in the city she lives in, they're pretty much ruled over by this very powerful syndicate of superheroes called the Renegades. And she has reason to despise the Renegades, and it is her life's mission to bring them down. And in book one, Nova is able to infiltrate the Renegades and kind of becomes a spy in their midst. But in doing so, she meets a boy named Adrian, who is a Renegade and happens to be the son of Nova's worst enemies. And the two of them, they start to sort of develop some feelings for each other, not realizing that at the same time, their alter egos are becoming arch enemies. Dun, dun, dun. That's what the book is about, yeah.
So the title of this panel is Deadly Magic. And so one of the elements that kind of tie both of your stories together are the idea of vengeance, justice, and destiny. Without giving away too many spoilers, can you talk a bit about how the role that these three elements play in your stories? Tochi, I'll start with you.
So I think that's a very, very good question. And it's funny too, because I was talking with somebody just last night about vengeance and revenge stories. The Count of Monte Cristo, for those that I was talking with earlier today, is like my favorite story of all time because I think it's one of the greatest revenge sagas ever. It's like this man goes all out. He doesn't just go after you, he goes after your family, like, you know, your daughter who wasn't even born when he was like initially thrown into prison. Like, he goes after everybody. And you know, from one angle, that looks like vengeance. And then from another angle, it looks like justice. And I wanted Taj to be able to have to figure out where the line stood with that, because by the end of book one, he's been wronged in a very, very, very major way. And he has to make a decision in book two as to whether or not he wants to, or like what form payback's gonna take, and if he can even call it payback, because it's not just his life that's at stake, it's the lives of everybody that he loves, the life of his entire city, really. So yeah, I think that vengeance, justice, coin is a very interesting one to think about, just because, like, especially, you know, given that there's an element of violence in the book, and like that, when that gets thrown into the equation, how does that change the equation? But yeah, no, it's fascinating because I hadn't quite heard it put that way before, but it makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah, no, they're very similar themes also in The Renegades, and the dealing with at what point does it stop being vengeance? At what point does it become justice, or vice versa? And you know, obviously the language of it, we think of justice as, you know, this good thing, something we want to strive for, something we want to see in the world, and we think of vengeance as something, you know, dark and evil, and that will, you know, eat away at you and destroy you. But they really are so close together. It is a really blurry line, and so you definitely see that a lot in Renegades as well.
Especially when you like catch feelings for the person who like you want to take vengeance against, which I feel
just,
like
it complicates the
One of the things, Marissa, that I really loved about your book is that in a world of heroes and villains, Nova is essentially a villain, but she has this very complicated story. There isn't, she's living in this moral gray area of what is bad and what is good, what is right, what is just. What was it like writing this character who, honestly, when I was reading at some points, I was like, I hate her. And at other points, I'm like, okay, I can get it. She's hurt. She has this pain. She wants revenge. What was it like writing this character that is so, like, just, yeah, lovable, hateable?
Yeah, it's definitely a balancing act. And I love doing this. Like, I've written a number of villain stories now, and I'm fascinated by villains. And I do think that it's true. Like, in humanity, in reality, none of us are all good or all bad. Like, we all kind of live in these gray areas, and I think that everyone is capable of doing really horrible things. And I think we all have things in our past that we maybe regret or aren't proud of. Like, we've all done things that we would maybe cast as more on the villainous side of things. And then we all are capable of doing really great things and helping people and you know, doing good things in the world. And so I really get annoyed with, in fiction, characters who are all good, all perfect, all the time, never make any mistakes. And oppositely, the characters who are all bad and, you know, just awful and evil. And I think it's very possible to have a character who makes bad decisions, and as a reader, you can see them and like recognize this is a bad decision, and I don't agree with what you're doing, but I kind of get it. You know, that you can see maybe what drove them to that point, or what's motivating them, and you can kind of empathize with it and connect with it on some level. So that's kind of always what I'm trying to accomplish with the villain characters.
Hashtag Killmonger.
Yes, yes. Tochi, in your series, the Aki are these people who have the magic ability to eat sins. The sins are pulled forth by mages, and they take the form of these oily beasts. Where did this concept come from? Where did, like, that's such an original, bonkers, but awesome idea.
It's so visual. Yeah. It's such a cool visual image.
So there are sort of, I guess, two sides to the, or two aspects to the inspiration for that particular magic thing. And so the first was after law school, I did a lot of civil rights work, particularly in the criminal justice realm. So I worked for the New York Attorney General's office with regards to the mental health conditions of juveniles in New York County jails. And then after that, I worked with the Legal Aid Society, basically doing criminal defense work, but for parolees on Rikers Island. So every single day, I'm going into work and I'm being confronted with these issues of crime and punishment and sin and guilt. And then, you know, you throw in the racial and socioeconomic, you know, layers, and you start to see that it becomes very sort of pointed who gets punished for what, and that there is a difference with regards to who gets punished for what. And it's almost as though, you know, these sort of deficiencies in greater society get put on very specific, you know, shoulders. And that was something that I really, really, really wanted to delve into. The idea that some people pay for the way that society is structured, right? Also, I watched a ton of anime growing up. And like, anime fight scenes are literally my favorite thing. And like, I wanted to be able to write that too. So like, the idea of them, the idea of the Aki fighting these like huge monsters, like it was sort of like a boss fight in a video game, right? And so like, I wanted to write that. And so that was basically, it's basically social justice in anime were how I came up with the concept of Sin Eating.
I'm so excited to know that you like anime.
Fam.
I happen to be the founder of my college's anime club.
Get
it's one
out.
Of my big claim to fame.
Okay,
so
I'm going to slightly derail the panel with a very, very contentious question.
Now okay. I'm more nervous, okay.
I know, and we're putting it on wax too. Full Metal Alchemist original or Brotherhood?
After my time. Never watched it. I'm
See,
sorry.
You all saw.
Yeah, no, it's true. Yeah, that came out after I did my call. Okay, I'm not as cool as I thought I was.
No, I have to say, to your credit, you are like an OG anime watcher. If you're like in the 80s, 90s stuff, like that's OG, that's, you know. So I have to give
like
you your props.
Sailor Moon and Cowboy Bebop and Fushigi Yugi and like old school.
Okay, you're
old
redeemed.
School.
You got Cowboy Bebop in there. You're redeemed.
I love Cowboy Bebop.
I'm okay. So sorry, Alicia.
Okay, no. Speaking of Sailor Moon,
Let's talk about Sailor Moon.
Somebody here, I'm not going to say who, but somebody here used to write Sailor Moon fan fiction.
Who?
Not me. And I don't think it was Tochi. So.
I don't think I've let anybody see those.
I really want to read your fan fiction, for one. And two, have you ever heard of anyone writing fan fiction for your stories?
Yes. So, so where do I begin with that question? Yes, I wrote Sailor Moon fan fiction, and it was the best. And I have a lot of pride for my fandom. And it is all still available. My pen name was Alicia Blade. It's all still on fanfiction.net. So if you want to go read about Sailor Moon and Tuxedo Mask kissing, that's pretty much all that I wrote. So it is out there. And yes, as a matter of fact, there is Lunar Chronicles fan fiction. And I very clearly remember the day that a friend of mine emailed me to be like, Marissa, there's a Lunar Chronicles section on fanfiction.net and there's like 8 stories. And I literally ran around my house screaming. I was so happy. And it was like all of my dreams come true. And this big full circle moment of just everything I'd ever hoped to accomplish. Fan fiction. Yay.
That is kind of amazing to start out as a fan fiction writer and then to find out that somebody is writing fan fiction about
it's
your
It's the
story.
Biggest compliment. It is truly the best compliment of all time.
That is so awesome. I love like learning about authors outside of, I get your books and then I get to read them. But then I also love to like research and find out about you all before I get you up on stage. Tochi, you have a podcast called the Inner Cities Podcast that you host with Azel Williams. It's a satirical political podcast where the two of you discuss some of the latest and greatest political explosions. That's the only way I can explain it, is political explosions in this country. You talked a little bit about this, but how does politics influence your writing?
Oh, man. I can't escape it. Yeah. So, you know, I remember in school, so like I was poli-sci in college, and you know, you'd study politics, especially, you know, if you were doing international relations, you would see how, you know, certain academic concepts like civil war would happen in other countries. And like in books, it would be academic concepts. But, you know, politics is a very, very real lived reality. For instance, very, very recent example would be, for instance, felon disenfranchisement. So there was an amendment to the Florida Constitution that I believe was passed with regards to these, yep, exactly, with these past midterms that basically enfranchised 1.5 million formerly incarcerated people. So now those people can vote, right? And like that, that's politics, but it's also like a very real lived reality. And for me, those two things are now like inextricable. So anytime that I'm writing, I'm always thinking about, you know, the politics of a particular world. So a very big thing for me with Beasts and with Crown was income inequality. And so my home state is Connecticut. And if you want a sort of microcosm of America with regards to income inequality, like Connecticut is literally the model for that. You have in Bridgeport, one of the poorest cities per capita in the United States. And then right next door is Fairfield, one of the wealthiest per capita cities in the entire United States. They're in the same county. Right? And so that was really important to me when I was writing and developing the City of Coast, was to have, you know, the haves and the have-nots to like extreme degrees living practically on top of each other. And that's politics, right? Like who gets put where and what laws determine that, because there are always laws that like play a role in that. All of that is politics for me. So yeah, so it, like for me, it's impossible for me to divorce, you know, politics and lived reality, or politics and literature. Like, it's all, like, I'm living it.
Yeah, I totally understand. Like, you, especially now, I feel like it's impossible to escape that. And I had, you know, written this question thinking of your book, but also I think of your book as well. Is there a political element to the Renegade story, to Nova's story?
I try really hard to escape it. You can't escape it, but I do try.
There's no Russian investigation in Renegades, yeah, as far as I can tell.
No, not yet. Book three is coming. No, I mean, there is definitely a political element, and I'm the same way. I mean, I'm not nearly as involved with politics as you are, but it's impossible not to let it infiltrate and not to think about it. And especially when you're building a world, like if you're trying to craft a world that feels believable and that, you know, the people are actually living their lives and moving through this world, well, you have to ask some of those bigger questions about who is in power and what is the theology in place here and how does that trickle down? How does that influence the way that people are living their day-to-day lives? So it definitely becomes something that I find myself thinking a lot of or a lot about, even though I wish that I didn't have to sometimes.
I mean, as much as you do have an element of politics in your stories, both of your stories are also taking us away from the, you know, they're a relief from that. They are, you know, a little bit of, I can't think of the word.
A little escapism.
Yeah, a little bit
but
of escapism.
That's one of the wonderful things about fantasy and science fiction, is that they can both provide that escape from reality while at the same time kind of teaching us about reality.
Yeah, creating these beautiful escape worlds that, yeah.
No, definitely. And like, just to very quickly piggyback on that, I think, you know, at least for me, it's very important with regards to representation on the page, because I would read a lot of science fiction and fantasy growing up, but I didn't see anybody who looked like me having these adventures or falling in love or saving the day. And to be able to see that in a book now, I think is part of that relief, right? Because, you know, you're living in this world that's taking every opportunity to tell you that, like, you don't matter, right? But then you can crack open this book and you can see that you're the love interest. Like, somebody who looks like you is the love interest. Somebody who looks like you is the hero. Like, that's, I think, a very important element of that for me, too.
Yeah, no, and I feel really proud to be writing in the YA genre right now, because it has become such a pervasive theme in YA and in our discussions and in the media. You know, there's such heightened awareness about the importance for diversity right now, and the change that we've been able to see in the books that are coming out and being released in even just the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, it's been incredible.
So I'm going to ask a little lighter question now that we're talking politics and we're all like, ugh. So in Renegades, magic comes in the form of prodigies, and there are people who have unique abilities. Some of them, they use their abilities for greatness, to be superheroes, I guess, to fight crime. And some are use their abilities for more nefarious purposes. And some prodigies have abilities that aren't very useful. Like, I think of the young girl who could, like, blow her head up like a balloon. Not really sure what that's going to
cool
be
cool party trick.
Yeah. Right? I'm sure you've been asked this question a million times, but what would your prodigy ability be and why?
So do you mean, like, if I could have any power, or, like, do I think is my in real life superpower?
Either one works.
Well, I like to joke that my in-real-life superpower is writing really awesome query letters. It's a secret skill of mine. It's true. I'm really, really good at it. But if I could have any superpower, I don't know. I mean, I do get asked this a lot, and I feel like my answer is always changing. It's like, what do I feel like doing today? I have to clean my house. I wish I had telekinesis. Just move things around. I'm on book tour. I wish I had teleportation. Snap my fingers and you're in Portland. Like, that would be really handy. So it changes. It changes.
Fair enough.
What superpower would you want, Tochi?
Yo, if I could fly?
Yes.
Fam, I would have all the legroom in the world.
Flying is a classic for a reason. Yeah. Like, there's a reason everybody wants that superpower. Yeah. I think of ones like fire is a classic power to create fireballs. And I'm like, if I had that power, I would light birthday candles. Like, it's not as useful, I think, as people like to believe it would be.
Mom would kill me. I'd mess around one day, snap my fingers, and all of a sudden, like, I don't know, like the chicken. Say, for instance, okay, mom goes out, and she's like, before she leaves, she's like, Tochi, make sure you put the chicken in the oven, right? You know, the whole day passes, right? And mom's coming home, but the chicken is still in the freezer, right? So what do? I snatch it out of the freezer, throw it in the oven, use my superpower or whatever, and, like, try to light it on fire. Whoo, if I don't burn down that house. So I feel like that's how that would play out.
The way you're telling the story, I sort of feel like this might have happened.
Speaking of food, Tochi, in your series, food plays a really significant role in it. Throughout Taj's, like, very dangerous adventures, the moments of peace and community are always punctuated by food. Can you talk a little bit about that, about why food
Definitely.
Is so important to the story?
Well, I think in terms of writing craft, when you're building a world, it can act as a sort of cheat code. So hashtag pro tip, if you're looking to, you know, to fill out your world culturally, food is a very interesting and convenient gateway through which you can sort of explore a lot of dynamics. And also, it forces you to think about, how do people eat? So is it one of those things where you can get a meal just wherever, or are you forced to sit down with whoever you're with or with particular people when you're having your meal? So when I was a kid, mom would make fufu, which is sort of like mashed potatoes, but with a very different consistency. And what she would do, she gave us each like water bowls for us to like wash our hands in. And we each got a bowl of pepper soup. And then in the middle, we would sit in the circle. And in the middle was this plate that had this mountain of fufu on it. And so you would just take from the mountain, roll it into a bowl, scoop some pepper soup, and then you would eat it. And it would never have occurred to us to like each have separate fufu plates, just because like that's just how we ate dinner. So like things like that were a very important part of putting together this world. Also, like, Nigerian cuisine is peerless. So jollof rice, don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Nigerian jollof rice is the beginning, the continuation, and the end.
Okay, so I'm just
really excited to know that fufu is a real thing. Yeah. I totally thought it was something you'd made up.
Book. No, that joint is real. You get the right pepper soup with it? Oh my goodness, you are good to go.
I want to try this now. Where can we get this? Is this a thing that we can get in Portland?
Yeah, do y'all have the Nigerian restaurant hookup in Portland? Because if not, if the market's wide open, then I might, you know, if this book stuff don't work out, then...
Please, please make that happen for us in Portland. When I was reading it, one of the things I really wanted was, like, recipes in the bag.
I love like the chicken skewers.
Have you thought about writing a recipe book to like a supplemental recipe book? Because I was like, how do I make jollof rice? How do I make pepper soup? And then I'm like, I don't know how to do any of this stuff. I'm not going to look up, you know, on Pinterest. I want a Nigerian to tell me how to
make Martha Stewart's fufu recipe. Yeah.
Well, like for me, it's one of those things where, and I feel this is very, very much the case in a lot of immigrant households, where it's all done by feel. Like nobody writes down, okay, you need like a quarter cup of this and you need to put this, you know, in the oven for this long or whatever. Like you just do it. And I don't know, you just gotta watch mom one of these days. And then I think you'll get it.
Your ancestors are directing your hands.
Exactly. No, but okay. it really does feel like that, where you just sort of get into this dance. Like mom's making pepper soup or she's making jollof rice, and it's like she's captured by other words. I know this is like a weird way to describe the cooking process, but like it does feel oftentimes like other things are moving through her when she like produces the tastiest jollof rice I've ever had in my entire life.
So one thing that I experience as a librarian is that people come to us, and this, you know, Portland is a town full of writers. So people come to us and they want us to help them with research or help them with information about publishing or whatever, or just researching the topic that they're going to write on. Do either of you or both of you do research for your books, and how do you do that research? I want to hear that you do it at a library.
Well, I can say back when I first had this idea for the Lunar Chronicles, and I had never tried writing science fiction before, and I thought, okay, I want to write these futuristic retellings of fairy tales. And pretty much the very first thing that I did was go to my local library and checked out every issue of Scientific American that they had, and just like started flipping through this magazine and just trying to get a feel for like what is the up and coming technology and what are scientists working on right now and what do they think that's going to be possible in the near future, and just kind of started getting ideas for the technology that I wanted to have. And I think that might be my one librarian research story.
So I also do a lot of writing in libraries. So, you know, if I'm not, because I can Google anywhere really, but there's particular pleasure in Googling in a library and indulging in that sense of redundancy. But with regards to the research for Beasts and Crown, like a lot of that was just drawn from my life and my heritage. So I think that the bulk of the research that I really wound up doing was eating mom's food.
So for both of you, you create very lush worlds. But for whatever reason in my head, I'm always trying to figure out, where is this? Like, where is Gatlin City? You know, what is this location supposed to be on our globe? Do you have a place where your story takes place, or is it a fantasy place outside of our known world, outside
of our
globe?
I'm very curious about your answer, Marissa.
I'm asking both of you this.
Yeah. So it's definitely on our planet, because there's references to, like, you know, the Philippines and Italy and whatnot. But I tried really hard not to put Gatlin City in a particular country. So that's the easy answer. The other answer is that it's very much inspired by Manhattan, which is also kind of a Gotham City-esque vibe, is very much what I was going for. Again, inspired by Manhattan. So, like, if it were going to be a known place, it would be Manhattan. But I don't want it to be Manhattan. It's Gatlin City. It's its own thing.
Fair enough.
Yeah, no, I was definitely getting Gotham City vibes.
Yeah, but I
also
was too.
Like, yeah, you take the PATH train to New Jersey out of Gatlin City. Like, yeah, so Kos is based on Lagos in Nigeria. And it's wild because I was just there like last month. And my mom grew up in Lagos. And the way that she describes this city, it's like the wildest city in the world, right? Everybody's got a hustle. The traffic is legendary. Like, you will spend 4 hours bumper to bumper. Like, you think LA traffic is bad? Child, you have not seen traffic until you see Lagos traffic. Also, everybody's got a hustle. Like, the mosquitoes will hold you up at gunpoint. Like, it's wild. But the way that she describes the city, she has like the biggest smile on her face. And that was something that I wanted to capture, was a city that was that chaotic, but that you almost had no choice but to love. And I think that is probably the biggest inspiration, like geographically, for the city of Kos.
One thing that I really appreciate, I don't know if this is even a question, I'm just telling you that as a reader who once, when I was young, the books that we had that teenagers had to read were like Sweet Valley High. And if you've ever seen Sweet Valley High, you know that there's nobody who looks like me on the cover of Sweet Valley High. What I really appreciate, and I think that young folks appreciate, is that you bring these stories that are mirrors and windows for a variety of kids who, you know, at one time really didn't have a story that was being told about them, or the story that they could connect with. Do you want to talk a little bit about how important it is for you to make sure that your characters represent a wide variety of folks?
Sure, I can go first. So for me, it's a lot of it is just trying to bring a sense of reality to the books. Obviously, we don't all look the same. We don't all come from the same backgrounds, the same social classes. Like, we all have come from different experiences, different cultures, different ethnicities, et cetera, et cetera. And so a lot of it is just trying to populate my fictional worlds in a way that real life is populated. And you know, just make it seem very kind of organic and rich and believable. On a more nerdier aspect, for me, like, being into anime, me and my friends used to go to like anime conventions and do cosplay all the time. And I had friends who were, you know, Asian and Black and different ethnicities. And there were so many times when we'd go and we'd like want to do a group cosplay and they didn't have people who looked like them, so they would just pick their favorite character, and that was fine. But when I started writing the Lunar Chronicles, one thing I thought from the very beginning was, like, I want every one of my readers to have at least one character that they could cosplay and feel like they really matched the look of them and, like, totally killed it. So that's always one of the things that's kind of in the back of my head, too.
No, definitely. I think, like, when you get to cosplay level, like, you've made it. Like, you go to Comic-Con and you're like, you are dressed like a character in my book. Like, forget the Times bestseller list, forget all that. Yo, yeah, so that's
a moment. It's totally a moment. Yeah.
Oh man. No, but I think the reality point is, like, super important because, like, there a lot of the conversation with regards to diversity and inclusion in books will you know, focus on, you know, appealing to a wider readership and letting, you know, people from different demographics know that they can, on a you know, very emotional level, really vibe and belong in a story, right? That they matter, that seeing themselves validated in this particular way in fiction can really reaffirm how they're able to move through their lives. But I also think the reality is, like, really important. If I'm going to write a second world fantasy that's based off an ancient African city and I don't have black people in it, like, what am I even doing, you know?
You've missed something there.
Yeah, I feel like I took a left turn somewhere if that's how that, you know, ends up being. So I think the reality thing is really important, and I think that sort of winds its way towards, you know, when we do start seeing stories that are based on, say, for instance, non-European mythologies or non-Western cultures and whatnot, that almost by necessity will, like, guarantee or demand that we have, like, a more representative body of characters in a particular story. So I really think the reality aspect is really important because, like, you'll get a lot of people that will say that, oh, there are no characters of X race in my book because that's just, like, you know, those people wouldn't, like, be in my town, or, like, I wasn't around those people growing up. And, like, I mean,
it's a little lazy.
Yeah.
It's super lazy.
Yeah. And I'm like, and also, too, I think just on a craft level, difference breeds conflict, right? So you have sort of ready-made story, you have ready-made drama when you have characters who on a very fundamental level have this difference, whether it's regards to race or gender or class or what have you, right? If there's that difference, then you can really get something going.
So we had an opportunity, we've been talking a lot about your books and, like, delving into some of the elements of your books, but I'm really curious, like, going way back to the very beginning, what is that initial inspiration, initial seed that was like, ooh, I gotta write this?
It was actually, it was an image. And this has happened on occasion where it'll be like a specific image that doesn't necessarily have a source. Like, I couldn't do a Google image search of this thing. It was just something that popped into my head. And it was probably video game inspired. I think I'd been playing, like, Shadow of the Colossus recently. But it was this image of this, like, boy, and his back was to me. And in front of him was, like, this beast made of shadows that, like, could fill this entire room. And, like, that was it. It was just a still image. And I knew nothing about this boy. I knew nothing about how that happened. But I had to figure it out. And I think a lot of, you know, we talk about the origin story of books as though there's this linear progression, right? Like, I had the idea, and then I wrote down the idea, and now it's a book.
Just like that.
Just like that, you know? Steps 1, 2, and 3. Rinse, repeat. But there, like, all these different things sort of come together in very sort of serendipitous and like, pretty much magical fashion, and it's, in a lot of ways, it started with that image, and then all this other stuff got grafted onto it as a way to explain that image to myself. It's sort of like how you have a dream that's the answer to a question that you don't know that you're asking. Like, there was this, I can't remember his name or whatever, but he was a scientist that, and he had this classroom of students, and he figured out the like equation for the like the benzene ring, which is some like weird scientific thing, and this huge like intractable problem that he was able to solve. It came to him in a dream, right? And he was explaining this to his students, and his students are like, oh, isn't that fancy? Like, you have a dream and you solve this like 500-year equation or whatever. But his response was, dreams come to prepared spirits. And so that always really stuck with me because I think on some level, I'd always wanted to write the story involving that boy and the beast, and then came the answer, and then came me, like, trying to figure out how to get there.
Do you remember where you were? Like, did the vision, the image come to you in a dream, or do you remember?
I was awake. I knew I was awake. And it was probably because I was not paying attention to something that I should have been paying attention to. I'm pretty sure those were the circumstances, yeah.
No, like, I should have been doing your taxes, and you're like, a beast.
I just, a few weeks ago, gave a keynote speech at a festival that was pretty much all about ideas and where ideas come from and kind of like what's happening in your brain between like, we go through life and we gather all of this material around us and we don't really realize that we're doing it. And then, you know, when you're in those idle periods, whether you're not paying attention to something you're supposed to be paying attention to, or you're, you know, asleep, or you're in the shower or whatever, then like your subconscious can start sending the answers up to you. And it feels very serendipitous, but there's this really cool scientific explanation that I'm like fascinated about. Brain science, I love it. Okay, so for the Renegades, the original idea came, I was on book tour, and I was sitting in the back of this car, and we're driving to a book signing, and we drove by a big construction zone, and there's like a sign on the fence that's like, coming soon to this location, one of those signs, and I just like caught a glimpse of it out of the corner of my eye, and I thought that it said, coming soon to this location, Hero School.
Hero School. Oh my gosh.
What? Yes.
Can I go?
I got so excited. And so I did this double take and looked back, and it said something totally different.
It's that Xavier School for Gifted Youngsters.
I know, exactly. Yeah. The X-Men, they're here. So it said something totally different, but that kind of started me thinking like, oh, I wish there was a school for superheroes. And then I was like, no, I really wish there was a school for supervillains, because that's where all the cool kids would go. But then like they would have this really intense rivalry between them. And what if a girl from the villain school fell in love with a boy from the hero school, but they didn't realize that they're supposed to be our enemies? And that's where it started, yeah.
I want to go to hero school.
Oh,
I used to want to go to wizard school, but now I kind of want to go to hero. Actually, I want to go to villain school, because
it's where the cool kids go.
I kind of connect with them.
Yo, those high school football games must be lit.
Right? Literally.
I actually tried to write like the first 3 or 4 drafts of the book, still including the school aspect. And so there was like one of the drafts of the book was super like high school drama, and like the villain school would always go and steal the hero school mascot every year. They got so mad about it, and yeah, it's a very different book now.
So this is my last question. I know we have a lot of young folks in here who are probably thinking of writing or really want to write. Do you have any tips, advice for would-be writers, especially would-be fantasy writers?
So the thing that I wish someone would have told me when I was aspiring, even though I probably wouldn't have listened to it, but nevertheless, it's good advice. I wish someone would have told me to take my time and to be patient with myself. I was so impatient with trying to get published. Like, it was this huge dream. I wanted it so bad. And so I started trying to write like my first original novels when I was a teenager. And I would set up these goals for myself, like I'm gonna finish this book by the end of the summer, and I'll have an agent by Christmas, and I'll be published by, you know, like next Tuesday, and I just like had these goals, and then when they didn't happen, and oh, I would write this book and it still doesn't work, and this is junk, and I'd throw it away, and I'd start a new one, and it's still terrible, and I still can't do this, and like I would just be so hard on myself and get so frustrated, and at the time I felt like I was wasting time, and like all of these pages you just wrote and they're junk and it's such a waste, and why can't I get this right? And now I look back and I realize like it wasn't wasted time. They weren't wasted pages. That's how I was learning. That's what I needed to be doing. And so I wish that I could have just like relaxed a little bit and taken some of the focus off of getting published. Like, getting published is awesome, and it's a great dream to have. But I wish that I had maybe not been so stressed out about getting published and taken more time to actually enjoy the process and enjoy the journey that I was on, because I can look back now and realize how magical it was.
Yeah, no, that's like really real. I used to do the deadline thing too. Like, I think I started querying at like 15 or 16. Like, just ridiculously, I had no business trying to sell a novel. But I think the Aragorn trilogy had like come out, and so he was like 15 when he did it.
He was so young.
Yeah, and so I was like, I mean, it's
and the rest of us were like, we're failures.
Yeah, well, like, I was like, he did it, so like, obviously it's a thing that can be done, right? I'm gonna be a published author by the time I'm 15, and then 15 turned into 16, and then it was like, okay, by the time I finish high school, I'm going to have a novel on a shelf in a Barnes & Noble. Spoiler alert, that did not happen. But there's always college. That's like a whole 4 years, right? Like, I should be good enough at the end of these 4 years that, like, by the time I graduate college, I'll be a published author. And that didn't quite happen. So, like, you know, you kept going. But, like, and I, too, was very impatient. So, like, normal people would write a book, polish it, like, do the whole query process or whatever, pick up a bunch of rejections, and then be like, okay, something's not working. How can I improve this book, right? How can I make this better? I was just like, I'm gonna write a better book.
That's pretty much my strategy, yeah, too. So
I just did that like 15 times. And like, the books got better, and it was cool because I did feel as though I was learning things. So I would finish a book and realize that I did a really cool like character thing with this book. Or with the next one, I was really interested in plotting structure, and so like the architecture of that novel. So I figured out how to do that. And then in the next one, I created this setting that I was like really proud of. And it was just a matter of trying to get all those things to happen at the same time. So I did feel as though I was making progress, but like a lot of time was passing and I still wasn't being published. So if I had advice that I would give to any aspiring writers, it would be to love writing. That I think has been the single greatest thing that has like pushed me through, because I tell people, oh, like I wrote 15 books before, you know, Beasts came out, and they're like, yo. And like, you think about it too, any other line of work where for 15 years they're like, no, like you can't do this, or like you're doing it wrong, or you're not like what we're looking for. If you heard that for 15 years straight, you'd be like, oh, maybe I just need to find a different line of work, right? But I just loved storytelling so much. I loved just even like nerdy things, like putting the ways that you could put sentences together. Like, I loved that stuff. So there was no way that I wasn't going to write. It's just a matter of whether or not I was gonna be on a Barnes & Noble shelf or not.
And I think that's also really important to the like have the love of writing, like feel where the passion comes from. Because even like a lot of people, when you're aspiring, you see publication as the goal. This is the end goal. It's not the end goal. You know, when you get your first book published and then you write another one and then you write another one. And the game changes. Like there's different pressures and different stressors and deadlines. And, you know, suddenly you have like editors and people who that care what you're doing with your time all day. And you know, there's a lot of writers who, once they get to that point, they kind of let the pressure get to them, and it can be really easy to do. But if you have that internal love of writing, you can always come back to that. Like, that never goes away. That can't be taken away. And so I think that's so much more important than publication or anything else that comes along with it.
That's great advice. I'm kind of a little inspired to write myself, but the reality is I don't even like writing emails, so probably should not be writing books. I'd love to open it up to audience questions. You right there. So the question was, have you ever written something wrong? And if so, do you just continue forward with that, or how do you fix that?
For me, I like to write really, really fast drafts. So when I'm powering through a draft, if I write something And then after I've written it, this actually just happened to me today, as a matter of fact, when I was riding on the airplane coming here. And I realized that, you know, this plot twist had happened, and wait, no, actually, it should have gone this way, and this would make the story way, way better. And so I'll just go back in every chapter that plays a role, I'll leave a note at the top of the chapter, change this to this, change this to this. And then I just pretend that I've made the change and just keep on writing as if it's already been made.
Oftentimes when I'm writing, there'll be what I call happy accidents. I plot in general broad brushstrokes and then I start doing chapter outlines, but I do like maybe a couple chapter outlines, like three, before I actually start drafting so that I know where I'm going, but at the same time I leave myself enough room to be surprised. Because characters will often do things that I hadn't initially planned. There's this sort of really magical thing that happens where they like decide to surprise you or decide that, oh, you have an outline. Oh, wouldn't it be a shame if something happened to it? So there's, and sometimes I just let myself be guided by that and then like, you know, change the outline accordingly.
Yeah, there's a famous quote that's writing is rewriting, and it's true. You have to rewrite, you have to revise all the time.
So this is the end of this panel. I know you all had more questions, but you will have a chance to meet them for a second and get your book signed. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was a conversation between Marissa Meyer and Tochi Anabuchi from the Portland Book Festival in 2018. The Portland Book Festival 2020 lineup has just been announced. The festival will take place online and on the radio November 5th through the 21st. For more information about the author lineup and schedule, visit literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Hahn, on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More at colehahn.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast, with production oversight by Amanda Bullock and support from Liz Olofsson. Special thanks to Jyoti Roy and Alana Phelan and the entire Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another episode of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.